Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Ancestry.com.au. From birth, death and marriage indexes to military records, passenger lists and police gazettes, Ancestry.com.au helps me find a lot of the personal details that bring to life the people you hear about in each episode of Forgotten Australia. And by joining these genealogical dots, you could bring your family history alive too. For more information, go to Ancestry.com.au because there could be more to your story. Forgotten Australia is written and produced by me, Michael Adams, in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, on land traditionally owned by the Darug and Gundungurra people. I pay my respect to Aboriginal elders, past and present. It's a grim day in September 1883 in Ararat Jail in Victoria, and murderer Robert Burns is about to be launched into eternity by colonial hangman Elijah Upjohn. In just seconds, Burns' life will be extinguished, his crime expiated, his soul sent to heaven or hell, and his body buried in quicklime in an unmarked grave. That should be the end of the story, but it won't be, because Robert Burns has a confession to make to Elijah Upjohn.
So Upjohn said that Burns confessed to him on the platform, "I've cooked 8 altogether, 5 in Victoria and 3 in New South Wales. And now you're going to cook me."
Whoa. Burns reckons he's murdered 8 people, not just the one he's about to swing for. Flash forward 140 years, and Bendigo woman Julie DiBella is using Ancestry to research her family history when she makes an amazing discovery. Robert Francis Burns, one of Australia's earliest and most prolific serial killers, is her great-great-grandfather. Not only that, but her family tree includes the hangman and one of the murderer's victims. I'm Michael Adams, and today I'll be speaking with Julie DiBella for this Your Story's Forgotten Australia episode, "My Great-Great-Grandfather Was a Serial Killer." Julie, let's start in the little gold rush town of Deepleed in Victoria in January 1882, with a miner named Harry Wilson making a gruesome find. Who is it? What's happened?
Charles Forbes, or Blathering Charlie. And he was found in a decomposed state without his head, and his body had been horned and moved by cattle and eaten by wild cats and dogs, so quolls and dingoes.
Dear God, so Charlie was blathering no more.
No.
Poor Charlie. Now, a naked, headless body's terrible, but a diligent constable named Hillard finds a clue that's going to lead to the identification of Charlie Forbes, because, you know, originally he's got no head and he's pretty messed up. What's the clue that the constable finds?
His brother and his workmates were able to identify him by the coat, and they remembered when he got the pipe hole on it.
So from a pipe ember, he's burned a hole in his clothing, and that's how he's been identified. It's remarkable, isn't it, when you read these old accounts? Like, you know, these people had so few possessions, so few pieces of clothing, that, you know, a single garment, the person would be identifiable from that because they would probably wear it all the time.
So with the other victim, who I know we'll get to later, he was identified by his sister because he had a muffler, another word for a scarf, and she recognised it because he was going to give it to her to wrap the baby in.
They've identified Charlie Forbes. How do they link him to Robert Burns?
Burns was the last person seen with Charlie, and they both walked off in the bush together towards Deepleed. The police do a really good job of backtracking and finding out who Charlie was, where he worked and where he'd been seen, the last place he'd been seen. And they tracked it through to a few different... They travelled from town to town, just tramping around, and drinking. And so they would go to, the police went to inns, boarding houses, hotels, general stores, and made a chain of evidence to work out where they'd been.
I read in your wonderful research that Robert Burns had also been seen needing a grindstone for his axe and had made quite a big deal about getting his axe nice and sharp. I mean, could he have looked more suspicious?
No, and he had a scratch on his face. He went to one of the local council supervisors to ask for work, and he noted that he was trembling quite badly, and Burns just put that down to, being out on the drink.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that I found was supposedly they'd gone out into the bush to chop wood. It was the middle of summer. So unless they were chopping wood to cook on, I'm not really sure why it would have been such a big deal going out and chopping wood.
So Burns and Charlie had last been seen together. It didn't look good for Burns. They've come to arrest him.
Yep. They arrested him at the Rapunyup Hotel. They got him out of bed, and then as they were putting him, they called it a cab, but I gather it was horse and buggy. The constable said to him, "You're being charged with the murder of Charlie Forbes." So he sort of says, "What? Charlie Forbes is alive. He's up in Sydney. He's up in New South Wales."
All right. Well, let's leave 1882 there for a moment. Robert Burns has said that Charlie Forbes is alive and well and up in Sydney. And let's flash forward 140 or so years to you, Julie. Who are you? Where are you from? And what do you do with yourself?
I'm from Bendigo in the Central Goldfields. So, we've still got that golden triangle thing going. I'm a almost retired social worker, and I'm also an author on the Sharpie subculture or counterculture of the 1960s and 1970s. And I think that's it.
So you're interested in history. Writing about the Sharpies, I mean, like the Bodgies, they were quote-unquote menaces to society. Are you a bit of a true crime aficionado?
Yes. And I was also a former Sharpie as well.
Oh, right. Okay. So you were a menace to society yourself.
I was a menace to society.
Right. Well, we won't go into your criminal history too much. Back in 1882, the Victorian police have Robert Burns in custody. But a few years ago, why were you on his trail?
I decided that I wanted to work out when each of my ancestors arrived in the country. And when I got to the Burns and sort of O'Leary line, I saw that both had died in 1902 in Brunswick. And I thought that was a bit weird. Like, what did they die of? Did they get sick? Did they have an accident? Or did one die of a broken heart after the other died? And I didn't have any leads on it in Ancestry. So I used Google, and it led me to an essay written by a member of the Mount Rouse Historical Society, and he'd been doing some research and discovered that Burns and supposedly another victim were drinking together at the Penshurst Hotel. So in this man's research, he had his full name. I had it as Robert Henry Burns rather than Robert Francis Burns. But when I saw the wife, and he also listed the names or the dates of the children's birth and where they were born, so I knew straight away that it was him.
So the headline here, though, is you're looking for your great-great-grandfather, and all of a sudden it pops out that this bloke, Robert Francis Burns, is a multiple murderer. So you had no idea about Robert Burns, the killer, at all before this moment?
No. No one alive in the family did either.
How did you feel at that moment when you went, oh, this is definitely my ancestor?
I still spent about another 4 hours trying to disprove it because I didn't want to run around and sort of start saying to people, this is a fact, if I had it wrong.
Yeah.
So then what I did, the two or three other people on Ancestry that had also had him, as an ancestor, and they also had the wrong name, Robert Henry. I sent them the essay and just said, what do you think? And they all came back and confirmed that they agreed that that was him.
Now, have you used Ancestry DNA at all to establish further links?
Yes.
When you had contacted the other people on Ancestry and confirmed and reconfirmed that, yes, indeed, you are the great-great-granddaughter of potentially a serial killer, how did you feel then?
Excited, but not, you know, not like in a creepy way, but, you know, I have a bachelor in criminal justice.
Wow.
So I'd view crimes a little bit differently.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to speak to my cousin in America because she spent more time with our grandfather. And but I had to wait till the time zones were right. So I was just waiting all night to call her. So when the time zones matched up, I messaged her and said, can you talk? And she said, oh, no, not right now. I'm about to go for a walk. Is it important? And I said, yes. And she rang me straight away. And I told her.
Oh, what do you mean? It's 100, that's 140 years. Come on, I could have waited a little bit longer, surely.
No, I couldn't. And so I said to her, you know, did you have any inkling at all? And she said, no. Mm. So then she asked her mother without disclosing.
Yeah.
I asked my dad, and no, none of them knew anything.
Wow. So how did they feel when you revealed this? Were they kind of all as sort of intrigued and not sort of overly emotional as you were?
Dad just kind of took it in his stride, and I'm not sure about my auntie.
Mm.
They've both recently gone into care, so
okay. They've
got other things to worry about.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm. What's the reaction been like from other family members? Have you told everybody?
No.
Tell me why.
Because some of my relations, I doubt very much they'd ever read a true crime book or watch a true crime show or listen to a podcast. And I don't feel I have the right to shatter.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or even have them have to even contemplate it.
Fair enough.
So, like, I told my brother, but we haven't, you know, we don't tell the children.
You haven't made a T-shirt yet?
Not yet, no.
All right. Now let's go back to April 1882. The Victorian police have arrested Robert Burns for the murder of poor old headless Charlie Forbes. How did Robert Burns react to this? What did he say to the cops?
Oh, look, basically just with disbelief and, you know, just like, no, you know, Charlie's alive. And just said I had no reason, you know, I'd have no reason to do him in, something like that.
Did the police have a look for Charlie?
Yes. According to the reports at the time, it was one of the biggest, I'll use the word manhunt, but it's not quite, but, you know, wanted person. Flyers were delivered to every police station in the colony.
Wow.
One of the constables rode all around. He even came up to Bendigo. They went to New South Wales, couldn't find him, came back and told Burns, and he said, oh, I made a mistake, he's in New Zealand.
Ah, yeah, that old thing. So, I always get Sydney and New Zealand mixed up myself.
Yeah, it's the new and the new. New South, New Zealand. Yeah.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So so the detective the constable had to go over by steamer to New Zealand, and in the end, they couldn't find him. They even put out a reward of, I think it was £20, hoping that the children of Stall and Deep Lead would go out looking for the head in the bush.
Oh, wow. Has the head ever been found?
Not that we know of. It's amazing. I found reports of three separate heads being found in Stall after that, but none of them were his.
Right. I mean, Robert Burns must have been a fairly convincing character for the police to go to these lengths, or were they just doing their due diligence?
They were doing due diligence. Right. So I don't think they believed him.
Okay, then. They don't have the head. Fingerprinting's a decade away at least. DNA's 100 years away. What evidence do the police have apart from, you know, people saying, oh, they were together?
That's pretty much it.
So the police have got a chain of circumstantial evidence, witnesses placing them together, a body that's been found and identified as Charlie Forbes, Robert Burns giving multiple stories, none of which check out. They take him to trial. Does the Crown Prosecutor present a good case?
I think he did the best that he could. It was in town in the Melbourne Supreme Court at the time. When I looked at the list of jurors, and most of them were professionals or semi-professionals. So I think in the end they just decided that the jurors, they just couldn't quite be sure that it was Charlie because there was no head. So they gave him the benefit of the doubt.
Robert Burns got off.
Right. Yep.
End of story. Is it?
He walked outside and he was in Swanson Street and the detective came up and tapped him on the shoulder and said, I'm arresting you for the murder of Michael Quinlivan.
Okay. And plot twist. Who's Michael Quinlivan and how does this detective know this?
When the policeman was doing his due diligence, he remembered a case from Wycliffe,
mm-hmm.
which is not far from Dunkeld where Burns lived. Okay, so Michael Quinlivan was another body and he'd been found maybe a year before in similar circumstances. Both Charles Forbes and Michael Quinlivan were workmates of Burns. They all worked on the railways together. They shared tents together.
Was he headless? And
no, he had his head, but it had been caved in at the back.
Oh, okay.
And it was in a really remote spot. And I've actually been out there. I haven't found the murder place, but it was described as Slewski's paddock. So I looked it up and Slewski, I can't say the name properly, he had the mansion in the area. He had the run. And so when I went to the mansion had an open day and I went and had a look at
it.
And you could see around that there was just paddocks everywhere, but there were also lots of gullies.
Yeah.
So apparently the body was found down in a gully and it was quite a long time before it was found.
It's terrific going to those locations, especially if you can kind of go, okay, this hasn't changed that much in terms of its bush and really get a sense of how remote some of these places are sometimes.
Yeah.
Good on you for doing that. So he's found, is he dressed, Quinlivan? He's got clothes on?
Been dressed. Yeah, he must have had because they found the body, couldn't identify him. They buried the body as an unknown person.
Yeah.
And the policeman had kept the clothes in evidence.
Right.
And so he started thinking, I wonder if Burns has murdered Michael. So he starts investigating it, takes the clothes to Michael's sister. Michael's wife and two children lived in England.
Right.
So, and he was also an itinerant worker. So sometimes he would be gone for quite a while.
Yeah.
But he was always in contact with his family. He was quite close with them. So they, and I believe after the body was found, it might have been in the news that an unidentified body was found because around about that time, his family started receiving letters from Burns acting as if he'd just seen him and they'd had a conversation and he was going to Gippsland to select land.
Keeping him alive when that's pretty damning.
That was presented at court. And I actually believe that was the reason, because it was so calculated, they didn't go down the insane route. He was remanded to Melbourne for a little while.
Yep.
And then in, I think it was August of 1882, he left Old Melbourne Jail and went by train to Hamilton.
Yep.
And he was put in Hamilton Jail until they were able to have the circuit court.
They had like 31 witnesses describing him being with Quinlivan. I mean, as far as chains of evidence go, this is pretty solid, isn't it? What did the jury say this time?
Well, the first juror, because they were all local, mm-hmm. and I believe once he was arrested, obviously they didn't like him anymore. But from what I can gather, he probably had the gift of the gab.
Right.
He was always at the races. He was always drinking. You know, he was probably everyone's best mate.
Yeah.
Drunken mate. And apparently one of the jurors said something to the effect of, I'll eat my hat or I'll eat my boots before I have another man's blood on my hands. So the jury had to come out, or the foreman had to come out and say to the judge, I'm really sorry, we can't agree. And the judge said, well, can we give you any more evidence? And he said, no, it's not from lack of evidence. Mm. It's because we're just not going to agree.
Do you think it played into it that Burns was 43, he's married, he had, was it five children?
Five, yeah.
Superficially, at least, he looks like an ordinary, decent bloke. Do you think they just couldn't believe that, you know, this guy who they knew was capable of such a thing?
Yeah, maybe.
They haven't been able to return a verdict. That's not the same as being acquitted. So did the Crown decide they would try him again?
Yes, they did. And in the meantime, they'd also reopened a case some time before. Burns' tent mate that he worked on the railway with was around the Ararat area. He became very unwell while they were out working. So they helped him on the trolley and he was taken back to the camp. And then he became more and more unwell in his tent and he died. And the coroner came. Burns was one of the witnesses. His brother was one of the witnesses and another workmate. And the coroner said that he died from English cholera. And then they started to suspect that it was he'd been poisoned with arsenic. Whoa. So around about the same time that they exhumed Michael Quinlivan's grave, they also exhumed was it Francis Heenan? Charles or Francis Heenan? I should have had my notes with me. They exhumed Mr. Heenan's grave, and the the forensic scientist was all ready. But when they opened it, the water had got in there. The coffin broke open. The head rolled out.
Oh yeah.
All they could do was scrape up a bit of slime and put in a jar, and then that was taken by train into Melbourne for testing. But it was inconclusive, so there wasn't enough evidence to charge him with Heenan's murder.
Faced with the fact that their jar of bodily muck was useless to them, they really had to make this second trial against Burns stick, didn't they?
Yeah, they just really wanted to get it. They wanted to get rid of him.
And what did the jury say this time around?
They found him guilty.
Okay. So it's an automatic death sentence. The Chief Justice, William Stahl, is presiding. He gives, he's obviously going to give Burns a chance to make a statement before he pronounces sentence. What does Burns have to say?
Basically, he calls everybody liars.
Maintaining his innocence, he's not going to confess to anything.
No.
All right.
Didn't confess to anything and just singled out all the people that he felt were telling lies and why he thought they were telling lies.
There was a petition to save him. You've had a look at those materials at the Public Records Office?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I can't read the judge's notes of evidence because it's just like chook scratchings. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But like I picked out a couple of words like cold, calculating. It was interesting that the appeal was on some points of law. One of them was how many jurors had been challenged and stood down. And in the end, they ran out of jurors and they had to take a juror that was drunk.
Oh, that's not great.
No. So then there was an argument over, did the judge have the right to say, well, bring him back in?
Yeah.
We got no choice. And the other one was over some evidence. I think it was to do with the sale of Burns' block of land. Or maybe it was about poison on the train. Anyway, there was some evidence that was said at the trial and the judge struck it out. but his barrister argued that the jury had already heard it and it would taint their minds.
Right, yeah. But the appeal was rejected on the grounds, I guess, that the verdict wouldn't have been changed by any of those points. Even the drunk juror, which today would obviously be an instant mistrial. Mm. So Burns is going to hang at Ararat Jail. And this is where I came across Robert Burns when I was researching and writing Hanging Ned Kelly. So for listeners who've not read the book, it's about the hangman Elijah Upjohn, who'd hanged Ned Kelly in 1880. And poor Elijah was a bit of a hopeless drunk, and he was still in his job in 1883. So it was going to fall to him for the princely sum of £5 to do this job. Elijah went up to perform the execution in Ararat Jail. It was only going to be witnessed by a small crowd of jailers, police officials, reporters, doctors, rather than the good old, bad old days when thousands of people would turn out in Victoria to see someone swing. What did this crowd see when Robert Burns was led pinioned to the scaffold?
They just saw a man with the white cap on the top of his forehead, ready to be pulled down. The spectators were on the lower floor, and the trap was up a bit higher. I have been to the jail and had a look, and since then they've actually moved the stairs to the other end. And the jail is like, it is modelled on the same principle as Pentridge and a lot of the other old bluestone jails.
Let's leave Burns on the platform, hanging there, not quite hanging there as the case may be, and jump back as close to the beginning as we can get. What have you learned about Robert Burns's background? Where did he come from? What had brought him to Australia?
He came on his own. Oh, I think it was 1860.
How old was he then?
20, okay. 22. Wasn't very old. Yep. And then he's missing completely until he meets his wife, Ellen, in Adelaide.
And when did they get married?
68.
1868. So this is Ellen Leary, your great-great-grandmother. Now, they had five children that survived, otherwise you and I would not be talking. Which is a weird thing, isn't it? So they settled in Victoria. He is then supposedly has poisoned Francis Heenan in February of 1879, even though the police can't prove that. Then in 1880, Elijah Upjohn does his most infamous work by hanging Ned Kelly. November of 1880, this is just 3 days after Ned Kelly swings, Robert and Ellen have another baby and then they move to Stawell. Which of these children is your great grandparent?
The youngest.
When was she born? She was born in November of 1880.
Yes.
Right. So the baby
that
they
held.
So what was her name?
Ellen Anastasia.
So Ellen Anastasia is born 3 days after Ned Kelly's hanged.
I never made that connection. Wow.
To Robert, who's already, we assume, committed at least one murder by poisoning his mate. It's quite creepy, isn't it?
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Great-grandmother Ellen's born to your great-great-grandfather Robert, who by this stage has likely killed at least one person. Then they move to Deep Lead in January 1882. They find Headless Charlie. 3 months later, they've got Robert Burns. What did the police actually think had happened between Robert Burns and Charlie Forbes? Did they think that it had been a fight that had gone wrong? Was it premeditated? What was their theory?
They didn't have a motive, and so they decided that it may have been about money and possessions.
Right.
So apparently, and I read somewhere that he was actually called Bobby.
Bobby.
So
Bobby
yeah,
Burns.
So, yeah, Bobby and Charlie, Bobby and Blathering Charlie, were out on the piss, and I reckon they ran out of money when they were on their binge, and they pawned his watch, pawned Charlie's watch, and then they spent the money. And then at some stage, I think Robert went back and, or Bobby went back and got the watch. But there was a lot of investigation into the whole watch situation because they were making that as the motive, whereas it really didn't make sense. I mean, I know when, you know, I suspect that Bobby was a blackout drunk. I also know that there's a condition through my family called Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, which I don't know the full details, but it's like an advanced alcoholic brain dementia.
Wow.
And their alcohol-seeking behaviour is just from the minute they get up, it's where's my drink, where's my drink, where's my drink, where's my drink. So if Bobby had that, you know, it's likely he would have gone to any lengths to get a drink. But anyway, so the police and the witnesses, they all talked about that. But I think in the end it just came down to he was the last person seen with him.
Yeah.
And there was enough smoke, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, that kind of thing.
Yeah. How much did you find out about this trial and what were your sources?
I went to PROV, or Public Records Office of Victoria. Actually, I didn't go there. I got online, found out what files I needed, and I ordered them, and they digitised them and sent them to me.
Fantastic.
But of course, in doing that, then they're also available to the public as well.
Which is
great.
I mean,
they're always, yeah, they're always available to the public, but someone had to pay to get them digitised.
Yeah, that's so, such a, I do that too with National Archives files. I pay to have them digitised, and I think, well, it's, you know, giving something back because then they're available to everybody forever, which is, you know, great when they're, you know, 100-page files or whatever. Those PROV capital case files are amazing, aren't they? Because you see original letters, memos, all sorts of material. What did you find in there?
I think the two things that really stood out to me was the antecedents, so his priors, and the letter that he wrote from Ararat jail, I think it was, or it was either Ararat or Hamilton. I can't remember where he was remanded between being found guilty and being sentenced, but it was described in the media as a long rambling letter. And I liked seeing that and seeing his signature.
With the long rambling letter, what stood out for you and what did you feel as you read it?
Just let's blame everybody else.
Right. There was no acknowledgement at all of any failings that he had?
No, I don't think so. I'd have to reread it with that in mind, but no.
Make you feel that he was likely guilty?
Yeah. He didn't say he wasn't guilty, but at the same time, he didn't really come up with any defence to counter everything that was said against him, other than to say they were lying.
When you say his antecedents, are these his prior convictions or offences?
Yeah.
What had they on him before this?
Nothing. Just
right.
pretty much bad character and, you know, a little bit of drunk and disorderly.
So reading that first trial evidence, did you think the jury were expected to convict?
Yeah, I think so.
So it was a surprise when they didn't convict, but more of a surprise when Burns was rearrested immediately and put on trial again.
Yeah. Look, I think when I read all of that, I was still processing it myself.
Yeah.
And part of the reason why I wanted to go through it was, did he do it or didn't he? And what about the family?
Yeah.
And I was more interested in Alan and the children, to be honest, than him. And I did wonder about his motive. But that's, you know, the criminology side of me.
When you look at Robert's photograph, which is available in the Public Records Office of Victoria's files, what do you think when you look at him?
When I look into his eyes, I can actually see a lot of sadness and I also feel there's some kind of awful trauma in his background, and that's what I'd like to get to the bottom of, but it's really hard to go back that far in Ireland.
It is for sure. Know, but yes.
You know, did he have a brutal father?
The chances are that he probably did. Trauma and brutality were almost sort of, you know, the regular upbringings for people at this time, you know, subjected
yeah.
to war and criminal violence and poverty and famine and so on. I mean, obviously it wasn't recognised at the time that this was shaping them.
I mean, and not everyone that goes through trauma becomes a serial killer.
Of course not. In July 1883, a phrenologist weighed in on Bobby Burns, writing Hanging Ned Kelly, delving into this pseudoscience and how it led to the waxworks was one of the most colourful and intriguing angles to colonial Victoria. What did this head reader have to say about Burns?
I think he was cherry-picking and trying to make it look like Burns's head fit the criminal profile. The other thing, too, is there was another article that called Burns a phrenologist.
Right.
And they were watching him when they were doing the jury selection, and they were describing his darting eyes and the calculating way he was choosing the people. And, yeah, and I thought that was very interesting.
So he was an amateur bumpologist, as they called them, scanning the bumps of the jury's heads to work out which people would be more likely to acquit him.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it worked the first time, perhaps.
Yeah. And then the other weird thing I found when I was looking at Trove, at some stage, Victoria Police, they sent a whole lot of files over to Professor, I think it was Lombosco, overseas, for him to do phrenological study on some of the criminals, including Ned Kelly.
Yeah. It was still, even though it had been pretty much discredited by the 1880s internationally, Victoria in particular was still loving the phrenology.
Now, well, that's probably because we had all the criminals and the convicts.
Also, they were hanging a lot of people and hanging, like phrenologists loved nothing better than getting their hands on a nice fresh head. And the way to get a nice fresh head was to hang someone. And Victoria was still hanging people a lot more than they were hanging people in the UK and even in New South Wales. So I think that had something to do.
Yeah.
I think that had something
that
to do with it.
That makes complete sense. Yeah.
Per capita in the 1850s, Victoria was hanging more people than anywhere else in the world. They were right into it. And that's when phrenology really took root in Victoria because, you know, the phrenologists had this endless supply of nice, fresh criminal heads to run their fingers over and feel the bumps and then make casts out of. And, of course, then the phrenologist Sohia turned that into his sideline business, the waxworks, which became the Chamber of Horrors. So it was a nice little industry there. So Burns didn't get a reprieve. I love that you got the Executive Council's sign off on that. You've actually got the document there, including Graham Berry, the Premier, who also denied Ned Kelly clemency. So Burns was due to hang on the 25th of September at Ararat. Had Burns confessed at any point?
No, unless he'd confessed to his priest, the spiritual advisor.
Yeah.
But I think it was actually I think I may have got this information from you, that the priests used to just make them concentrate on their going to the afterlife.
They did, yeah. That was what they said.
Yeah.
Focus on eternity, nothing else matters now.
Yeah. So the priest may have known something and he wouldn't let Burns do a speech from the gallows.
One way or the other. Yeah.
There's a lot of kind of allusion to things that he wrote, but most of the ones that there were, it was just thanking his solicitors and the people that were nice to him.
Now, speaking of people who were nice to him, his wife, Ellen, did she come visit? Did she stand by him? I mean, it's a big thing that your husband and father of your five kids is about to swing. What was the story there?
She went and saw him in Melbourne when he was on remand and they gave them some private time together. I don't know that she went to see him in Hamilton, but it was a long way for her to get there from Stawell with five children. But she did go and see him when he was in Ararat, and when she was in there, apparently she was very vocal and called them all sorts of names. And, you know, and the press were a bit like, oh, you know, she shouldn't have done that. And, you know, I can completely imagine her, you know, imagine someone doing that.
Elijah Upjohn, the hangman, came up on the train to get ready. And in his case, that meant staying in the jail and trying not to go out and get drunk, at least this time.
Mm-hmm.
On the 25th of September, 1883, Robert Burns, aged 43, father of five children, married to Ellen, your great-great-grandmother, goes to the scaffold. Now, Elijah Upjohn could be a little bit slipshod with his work. He was not trained. He was not very good. He was also pretty new to it. He'd only done, I think, three executions, including Ned Kelly. How did he cope this morning?
Well, supposedly he was shaking and trembling, and he didn't get the slip knot in the right spot. So from what I understand, the ropes that we see when there's a hanging with that big knot in it isn't what they used. They had a leather eyelet on the end of the rope, and it went through it, and so then it just pulled tight. But apparently he had that part where it joined in the wrong spot, which meant that he probably would have strangled to death rather than be hung. Like broken neck, and that. So the governor, superintendent, he reached over and adjusted it, and it kind of almost sounds like he must have knocked. Look, I'm probably reading too much into it, but to me, it sounds kind of like he pushed Upjohn out of the way. And later on, Upjohn was said to say, "I was trembling because of how I have a natural infirmity," but he didn't say what that was.
He would
probably drying out from the alcohol.
He would actually claim to have a natural infirmity on other occasions as well. But, yeah, I agree. It was much more likely that it was alcoholism because it hadn't been detected in the 60 years previously in any of the known records. And he had been a convict, so it might well have popped up there or in his previous prison records. I think he was drinking, you know, and that's, again, quite understandable given the job that he'd taken on in desperation of hanging and flogging people. Did Burns die on the rope quickly and cleanly?
From memory, they said his knees jerked and he was, you know, dead when he hit the, you know, when the rope reached its end. And the at the time, the legislation was that the body had to hang for 1 hour. And they locked the doors and locked everybody in there with the body. And so I've been in the jail and I've looked where the scaffold is and I've stood underneath it, and if the staircase has been moved. But if you put the staircase back, I actually believe the body would have been hanging right in that stairwell at the bottom of the step.
Yep. So many people wanted to get access to these private executions and they would do whatever they could to get in there and see it. But then when they did, like a lot of them were absolutely horrified, and then they were stuck in this room with this corpse for an hour before it was cut down.
Yeah.
Now, being cut down wasn't the end for murderers in colonial Victoria. So he was given the phrenological examination, as was the practice at the time. Then he was buried in quicklime in a murderer's grave. That should have been the end of Robert Burns, but it wasn't, was it?
No.
Why was that? What had he allegedly said to Upjohn up there on the platform?
So Upjohn said that Burns confessed to him on the platform, "I've cooked 8 altogether, 5 in Victoria and 3 in New South Wales, and now you're going to cook me."
Whoa. So he's confessing to 8 murders in total, including, I guess, the one he's being hanged for, the one he was acquitted on, the poisoning that they couldn't pin on him, and then 5 more besides.
Yes.
He was prolific. Did the authorities believe Upjohn?
No. Nobody believed Upjohn. They said he made it up for notoriety.
Yeah.
The reporter that was there that didn't hear it was most put out and, you know, just said it couldn't have happened.
What's interesting is that the governor of Melbourne Jail, John Buckley Castillo, reporting on a 1872 hanging, he compared what the journalist wrote standing down below about the guy on the platform being really calm and and bold and all the rest of it. And he said, they can't see what I can see. They can't hear what I can hear because I'm right there. And he said the guy was much afraid and trembling. So a journalist down below saying that, you know, Bobby Burns hadn't said anything, quite likely just couldn't see or hear what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I believe one of the jail officials said, no, he would not have had a chance to speak without us hearing. But Upjohn said the officials were busy doing the bits that they had to do and the priest was administering the last rites.
And also Upjohn's, his job, once the noose is in place, is to lower the cap, which means he's got to have his hands on the guy's head and be that that close. So if anyone was going to hear something said softly or quietly, it would be him.
And I'm not sure whether it was when he was pinioning him or, you know, tying his hands behind his back. Yeah, it was one of those stages. But the officials all said no, that it couldn't possibly have happened.
Now, you have an interesting theory about how Upjohn, how both things might have been true in the sense that Upjohn had heard it, but he hadn't heard from Burns at that time. So I love this idea. Could you tell me what your theory is?
Okay. So one thing, when I read through it and a while ago I did a bit of research on all of the hangmen because I found them all fascinating. And so everyone was saying it couldn't be true. But Upjohn actually did an affidavit to say it was. And I don't know why, but I actually believe Upjohn was quite a truthful man.
Me too. Yeah. And he'd spent a lot of his time working as a night man in Ballarat, which is, you know, collecting people's poo. He'd had small businesses. I've read his letters to council. He was quite an erudite fellow. And I do agree that I don't think he was someone who would just make this up for no reason. I mean, he didn't really stand to gain anything from it. That's for sure.
No.
And what did the so he stuck to his guns. He wrote an affidavit. He kind of like almost gave a press conference, didn't he?
I think so, yeah. But then someone interviewed one of the maintenance groundskeepers at Ararat Jail, and this person said that Upjohn had actually told him that the night before the hanging.
Right, so he couldn't have said it. He couldn't have learned it on the day of the execution.
No, and so apparently it was word for word.
So how was it possible then for Upjohn to have gleaned this?
Well, I knew that Upjohn had a criminal history and I know there's a jail grapevine and I knew that Robert had been in remanded in Melbourne and was probably at Old Melbourne Jail. So then I went looking to see if they were in there at the same time or something like that. So what I did find was Robert left Old Melbourne Jail to be sent to Hamilton in August 1882, I think it was. Upjohn went into Old Melbourne Jail middle of September for obscene exposure to two women in Coburg. Everyone was following this case. It was huge. If you look in Trove, there's over 600 entries. And so Upjohn would have known about Burns. So he would have likely been thinking to himself, there's a good chance I'm going to hang this man.
Mm.
And I know I would have done my due diligence if I was in the jail and I would have asked around the other, the other prisoners. And, you know, I don't know what Upjohn's reputation was in the jail. Did they think he was a snitch? Did they think he was a lag because he was the hangman? I don't know. But, you know, he may have spoken to someone that said that was what Burns had said.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe Burns was big noting himself in the jail. And I think that if that was the case, that Upjohn felt a duty to let everyone know that Burns actually deserved to be hung.
Right. So we don't really know whether Burns had said it or not, or whether Upjohn had heard it directly or not. But what did they do in terms of investigating his claims?
Not Look, it doesn't seem like there was a real lot. I think the police probably thought there was no point investing more resources into the man who was already dead.
Not like you could hang him again.
No. And because there were so many unidentified bodies found out in the bush, because, you know, there was a lot of men that came out here on their own with no family.
So what did one of the journalists from the Herald do?
One of them did some investigation. I'm not sure where he got his information from, but the headline was Burns's Confession Sustained.
Now, these days, the actual list of supposed victims, I mean, it reads from, in my estimation, quite likely, as in the MOs are pretty similar, to fairly speculative. But at the time, from the Herald, it was agreed that Burns had killed many, if not all, of these eight people.
Mm. Like, for one that they were pretty sure that he did, it was pretty sure it was another headless body, naked body they found in Wagga Wagga. And apparently they believe he had been working up there at the time. The locals remembered him, his picture. The publican remembered him, and the railway contractor, they were doing the cuttings in the railway line. He said, yes, he worked for me, but he didn't have the payroll sheets anymore.
Right.
So there was no actual real evidence that he'd been there.
Yeah.
But the MO was the same. But even after Burns was executed, there was still a bunch of people being found headless in the bush.
What is absolutely astounding, in addition to you finding via Ancestry that you're related to Robert Burns, is you've also discovered you're related to Elijah Upjohn and to one of the victims. I mean, this is just crazy.
Yeah, through marriage.
Okay, but still?
Yes, it's through marriage,
That's so, like six degrees of separation over 140 years. It's quite crazy.
Upjohn is someone on my mother's side.
Yep.
So, a great aunt married someone in his family, and I'm also related by marriage through my father's side to the victim, Michael Quinlivan.
Dear God, that is absolutely incredible. So how has all of this left you feeling?
I'm still a bit bewildered.
I can understand that. Now, you've compiled a wonderful 300-page collection of archival materials. What do you intend to do with that, Julie?
So I think what I'm going to do is maybe pretty much leave it in the format that it's in the chronological order, and get permission to use all the bits and just publish it as it is, because I'm sure there's other people out there that just like to do a deep dive research into a particular subject. And they can do this without having to do all the trawling through the search engines.
Fantastic. Well, let me know when it's available and I will let everybody know. Julie,
yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much. I'm Michael Adams and this has been Forgotten Australia. I'll be back with a new episode very soon. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.